Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with homework? Are they asking questions that you're not sure you can fully answer? IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed. This program will improve your kids' grades. Studies done in almost every state in the country, the kids who had IXL are consistently doing better. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. And it doesn't have to eat up all your time. One subscription gets you everything for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. So don't miss out. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/audio. Visit IXL.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Welcome back to D.L. Hughley Uncut. Our first guest is an American commentator, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and novelist. It's Leonard Pitts, Jr.
How you doing, Leonard?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm excellent. I got to tell you this. I think that you're my favorite journalist, and I say that every time I talk to you. But lately, I would say the last few years, your writing, the focus point of your writing hasn't been as optimistic as it usually had been. Like there,
that's you an understatement.
You weren't exactly the most optimistic motherfucker I was reading. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Why was that? And what do you think will happen now?
Well, I think, you know, I'm dealing with two conflicting imperatives, if I can say that. I think as a columnist, one imperative is to always give people some sense of, you know, this is the way out, or this is what we can do better, or this is how we shall overcome, you know, some kind of happy ending. The other imperative is to tell the truth. And, you know, usually those things are not in conflict, but in the depths of Donald Trump's America, it became kind of hard to tell the truth and yet also leave you, you know, doing this.
Right.
You know, I tried. I really tried. But I'm not, the one thing that I can't do as a writer is lie. You know, I mean, that's just, to me, if I'm lying, you'll know it. That's
right,
how I feel.
Right.
If what I say is not coming from here, you're going to know it. So I can't lie. So yeah, I have been, you know, less optimistic than I have been than in previous years. I guilty as charged.
What would you say did the results of last week's election, did they harden you? Did they crystallize anything? Were they a relief, or what exactly would you say? How would you quantify your emotional kind
of? All of the above. It's you know, it's certainly better than the other alternative. But, before we get into deep analysis, let's just be clear. You know, it was a great step back to or forward to what we need to be. But the thing that I keep telling people is it's only a step, because, and it's become cliche at this point, Donald Trump was not the illness. Donald Trump was the symptom of the illness.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, we may have excised the symptom of the illness, but we still have to deal with the illness. So.
Now, you know what's interesting? How can you diagnose and treat an illness when 71% of Americans, 71 million Americans, didn't believe there was an illness and that this was the appropriate a response to it, that they believe that we were heading down the right path under this leadership. So I don't know what the chances are of having an effective outcome if most people don't even think there's anything wrong.
Exactly. The point that I made in a recent column, you know, yeah, I'm glad to see this happen, but 7 million more people voted for this guy after he destroyed the economy, after 236,000 of our people died who didn't have to die, most of them in the pandemic. After, you know, all the racism, sexism, misogyny, incompetence of this guy, 7 million more people looked at him and said, yeah, that's
please.
Mm-hmm. That's my boy.
I was reading your article and I said, you got to get him back, because I read it, but tell the people what the last name of your last editorial
was. Well, it depends. I don't know what the last one you saw is. Are you talking about the one in terms of people asking for reconciliation?
Yes. It's exactly that one.
Yeah, the last line of that column went something to the effect of, please don't ask me about what I'm going to do to reconcile with Donald Trump supporters. Better question, ask them what they will do to reconcile with me.
And you make the point that constantly black people always have to sacrifice their needs for what they're told is the good of their country, for what they're told is the idea if we want America to move forward. They did it in slavery. They've done it. There have always been even to some degree, the Obama administration gave up a lot of things to the detriment of black people for what we believe would be better for America, and we never get our return for it. I saw that article, and I agreed with you. I think that every time white people get mad, lose and get mad, we give them something.
Yeah. Yeah, we give them something, or we go out of our way to salve their feelings or whatever, and I'm just not feeling it.
Yeah.
And again, you talk about, you know, not being optimistic, and I look at having that feeling. Okay, if everybody feels like I feel, and, you know, there seem to be a lot who do, then how do we go forward from here as one country? You know, one nation, indivisible, all that other good stuff. And the answer is, I don't know.
Well, it's simple. Really to me, it really is a simple thing. I think that we have to understand the one thing about Republicans that I've learned, particularly under Donald Trump, they'll take a lot of the bad to get the good, to get the things they want. All the racism, all the misogyny, all the hatred, that's bad. But I got the tax cuts and the judges I want. So they will look they'll look the other way while these terrible things happen. They will hold their nose, and more of them will decide that whatever they got was worth the deal they made with the devil. And I think the people in charge, the one thing Republicans should have taught this administration is not just to have power, to wield it, to use it. And to use it to the people who have supported you.
Yeah. No, I don't yet. That's the key thing, to use it for the people who have supported you. And that's the one thing for me, Democrats have failed to do a
Absolutely.
Lot. They are always, Democrats are like the guy who has a girlfriend who maybe is not the most attractive girl, you know. And so while we're behind closed doors, we all bund up and we all boo. But when we're out in public, don't walk so close to me.
Right.
That sort of thing.
Let's not talk about my weekend endeavors, Leonard. Let's stick to the point. You need to stick to where we're at.
but that's how they treat black voters.
Sure.
That's how they treated black voters for years. You know, there's lip service, but when it comes to, okay, we're in front of the entire country and we need to talk about the things that we need to do for African Americans, then suddenly they get a little bit more mumble mouth.
You know,
I'm tired of it.
I think you're right. I think that this notion of appealing to a rural voter is a mythic and never, you know, they're myths. They're things that they will never, ever, ever vote for you. They never will.
You know the last time a majority of white voters voted for Democrat, right?
No.
Lyndon Johnson was in office. Okay.
Right. So
they have not had the majority of white voters since then. Okay, since 1964 was the last election where a majority, where Democrats had a majority of the white vote. Hadn't happened since and what happened between 1964 and 1968 to change that? Little thing called the Voting Rights Act.
Right.
Oh,
right.
You're going to give Negroes the right to vote?
Right.
You, as Lyndon Johnson said when he signed it, we've lost them.
Yeah, forever.
Lyndon Johnson said, we've lost the South for, the only thing he got wrong was he said, we've lost the South for 25 years.
No.
Now Lyndon been longer than that.
Why you bullshit, Lyndon? I think that this time, okay, there was an incredible, it's very hard to beat an incumbent president, no matter what. It hasn't happened that many times in our history. And particularly one that is corrupt and will use the levers of power legally or illegally. You'll steal mailboxes. You will take out sorting machines. You will enlist, armed thugs to kind of intimidate people. You will put judges in place you think give you an advantage. It's like having a cheat code in a game. And he still lost. I don't think he's as shocked that he lost. I think because I didn't think he thought more people would vote for him. I thought he thought all the cheating he would do would help him win. But there's never been a clearer example of the importance of black and brown people, because Biden didn't win Georgia. He won Atlanta and Athens. He didn't win Wisconsin. Yeah. He won Milwaukee and Racine and Philly. He won Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania. He won Philly and Pittsburgh. And just like in Vegas, he won in Nevada. He won Vegas and in Phoenix and Arizona. He won Phoenix. He won with large concentrations of black and brown people. And the caveat being that they threw the entire wealth and power and pomp and circumstance of the presidency and the white vote behind him and still lost. So people now can understand you can win just doing right by the people who support you.
Wow, what a novel concept. I'm true for them that support it. I'm going to chase folks that don't care about me.
Right.
I'm going to do for them that support me. You've never had to explain that to the Republicans. I don't see the Republicans. I used to write columns back in the 90s begging the Republicans, please, you know, chase the black vote. But I don't think it's healthy that one party has a monopoly.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
That's how they get to take us for granted. And the Republicans, I'm still waiting on the Republicans to answer. They have not changed.
Well, they gave you Lil Wayne. You got Lil Wayne and Ice Cube.
And Ice Cube, yeah.
Republicans don't need the black vote. They don't care. They pay enough lip service. You know, they say something nice on, you know, Martin Luther King Day and, you know, the anniversaries, whatever. But other than that, they don't care about
right,
us.
Right.
And the Democratic Party needs to come to understand we're who you got. We're who you date.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Right.
We're it. You
right.
know, us and some of the Hispanic brothers and sisters and a minority of white folks.
Right.
That's it.
That's who you got.
That's right. Your bait.
Right. It is, you know, when it's always funny because they always go, look at the map. It's so much red. All that means to me is white people got a lot of room. They got a lot of they got a lot of space. No wonder you guys are mad.
Vote.
So what do you think? I think that your approach is absolutely right. I think that the outcome should not be I'm going to supplant the wishes of those who have been my supporters for this mythic notion or this idea of somebody who hasn't will. And what would that look like to you?
What the Democratic Party needs
yes.
to do? It would look like more programs designed to alleviate income inequality, programs designed to alleviate job loss in the urban core, housing. It would look like education. It would look like what can we do about these food deserts? And Lord knows it would look like, I don't even know how I forgot to name this number one. It would look like doing something to get a hold of these renegade police departments.
Mm.
You know, I don't know how that came to be number five on my list.
No, but I think that they're all, they kind of rotate. I mean, I think that they're equally, but you're absolutely right. Once they stop killing us, we got to live somewhere. we got to go to school somewhere. I think that article spoke volumes. And I think that there's always, I remember when me and my brother would have a fight. And my mother would make me apologize because she knew that my brother wouldn't. You know what I mean? She would make me apologize because she knew I wouldn't. And in the end, she just wanted peace. And I think that too many times, they have just wanted black people to shut the fuck up and go away because these dudes with guns and rebel flags ain't going to go away. So I'll just give them the Electoral College or whatever else they need to make sure that they feel like I heard them.
It's got to be a different day. You see, what they're trying to do is make this South Africa circa 1985. They know that in a very short time they will not have the numbers, and there's nothing they can do about that. But they want to be able to have the power, even if they don't have the numbers. Again, South Africa 1985, and we cannot sit still and allow that. None of us who believe in what this country is supposed to be about can sit back and allow that. So this whole idea of this whole idea of this false equivalence or we all have to apologize or we all have to reconcile. No, mm-mm. We ain't wrong.
Period. That part.
I saw this on Facebook today, between the murderer and the murdered, between the rapist and the raped person, there's no half, there's no middle ground. You know, one side is right. One side has been done wrong. The better way to put it, one side has been victimized and the other side has been the victimizer. And so it's up to the people who've done the victimizing to make the other side whole. They need to repent, and then repent and repair what they've done.
Yeah. Repay.
They need
repay. Repay. Don't forget that one.
Well, the three R's is better than the three K's. I know that. That's Hey, man, it's always good to talk to you, man. Keep doing. Well, you know what? I'm looking forward to your articles perhaps being a little more. They'll be tinged with a little more optimism.
He's like, maybe.
He's like the short day of journalists. Jesus
maybe.
Christ.
He's like, let me think about it. Yeah, we'll see.
When I can do it truthfully and feel like, okay, I told the truth about what I feel, then that's what you'll get.
Good deal, man. It's always good to see you, Larry. You're the best, man. I'm telling you, looking forward to reading those articles. Take care.
Thanks, sir. Thank you, man.
Take care.
Our next guest is the co-writer, producer, and director of the film Antebellum, which is currently number one on Fandango for the third week in a row. It's Gerard Bush.
Hey, young man. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you guys doing?
Doing good. That's a winner's dance. I saw you doing that. I'm like, yeah, 3 weeks in a row.
Congratulations. That's a hell of an accomplishment.
Thanks, man. Like this whole thing, the experience with the backdrop of everything going on in the world feels even more surreal. But you know, you have to count your blessings when you get them. So I'm incredibly grateful that we're in this position that we're in.
I have a weird theory. I think we're in a position we're in. I'm talking about where social activism is on the forefront. And perhaps some of the things, and I think one of the reasons for that is because so many people are home and some of the distractions are gone, that they're seeing things in different ways and seeing things that they perhaps wouldn't have looked at it at other times. And I think it says a lot right now that the stories that men and women like in your position are telling are so nuanced. Why do you think, because you don't just write, but this movie clearly says a lot of, like Antebellum to me was, like Antebellum has been a musical group. It's now, it's been a source of torture for us, but now it's where white people get married. So, but you found a way to tell stories, to be entertaining, to be informative, and to be bracing. This is a very, and I think this encompasses all of it. Do you feel like that's your responsibility?
Look, I think that as a black artist, as a black American, as a citizen who's really concerned about the state of black America at the hands of white America, and by that I mean either an indifference or deriving direct benefit from the privilege of whiteness and not doing anything to correct the record. Me as an artist, as a black American specifically, I feel a tremendous responsibility to tell the truth. And I think so many of us, whether we know it or not, we've served as co-conspirators in performing the lie. And by that, I mean that the lie of the country's noble founding. The country was founded on the backs of stolen bodies and free labor. And my people, our people, are still suffering the residue results of that. And I can't tell a story or put something on the screen or put pen to paper without doing everything I can to amplify these issues and to bring them to the broader public for us to have a dialogue that hopefully we move into meaningful action.
But that's a very nuanced thing, because you have to do all of that, and it has to have commercial success. And people still got to buy popcorn. Slaves were terrible. Are those juju beads?
And not feel bad looking at it. It's true.
So, in the same way, when I do comedy, I write books, I've always tried to give them. My mother always said, she used to give us aspirin and orange juice. So she gave us something we liked with something in something. It's something we needed in something we liked. And I think the one thing I've seen about not only this film, but your, like this new kind of wave of directors and writers, you guys kind of embody that, where you kind of understand the financial ramifications, the commercial successful aspects, and then the storytelling part.
I mean, I think that we go into it knowing that, especially being black, that you're going to be judged probably by a different barometer. And we need to be commercially successful, which means that we also don't want to just preach to the choir of people that are already on board with what we're saying. We need to reach a broader audience, which also includes a bigger tent with white folk. And, you know, quite honestly, I think that not remembering the history and then having to confront it in a different way and using an access point, which hopefully this horror genre or an elevated horror is a new way of looking at it, which I think gives people an on-ramp into slavery, because for me, I'm really uncomfortable with watching my people in bondage. I think we all can be incredibly uncomfortable with slave narratives. But then at the same time, we also have a responsibility not to serve as co-conspirators in the erasure of our own history. And so how do I make stories or write stories or put movies together that can educate us on the history while also hopefully finding some way to entertain in those windows of opportunity that we have within the story for whatever could look like levity in such a serious story.
I think the things that I found that kind of have levity or they can cut the treacle are things that are so soberly true with irony. And I think you've done a masterful job of that. What is your goal when you, because I know for me, my goal is obviously in the end to have people listen and whatever reaction I get is what I get. But what is your goal specifically as a filmmaker?
My goal is for us to change or have an awareness of the stories that we're telling ourselves about ourselves.
Sure.
So this is only just the beginning of a much longer play. Ultimately, one day I would love to, you know, remake Mahogany.
As long as I get to be a piano man, that'd be done.
Better for me. This ain't nothing if you ain't got nobody to share it with.
Yeah. That's right.
I want to make a lot of different movies that speak about the beauty, and not the beauty and the resilience of who we are as Black people, but the beauty of the beauty of who we are as Black people. Mm. And I think that that is something I'd like to leave our audience with, white, Black, brown, and everything in between, is that there's a rich reservoir of stories to be told from the perspective of Black people. And if I look at a movie like Gone with the Wind, for instance, I think that's a horror film. I think it's a direct insult to Black people.
I think the same thing.
So what I did is I went and got the lenses from Gone with the Wind to shoot Antebellum on. So then I could use the same weaponry that was meant to create a really effective, beautiful piece of propaganda to then correct the record in modern day by recontextualizing what that is for 2020.
I can't wait to see what you do with the lenses from Birth of a Nation.
Ain't
that'll be
that
dope,
the
right? most of our story, all of our stories as Black people in the American experience start in the middle. There was nothing before and nothing after. We always are here. And another thing is we always kind of know what's happening because we know when the story starts in the middle, you don't have that much to go. And what have you done? If you really took the historical, the imaginational, the imaginary, and the aspirational and put it in one film, that's dope. Like, I would have never thought to do it. You did three things, so let's just give you three checks. That ain't gonna happen either. No, nigga, it's one check.
He knew it. He was like, yeah, that's probably not gonna happen.
Because literally, I don't like seeing stories about Black people because I know what happens, and we never have triumphs, and they always start in the middle, and we were never anything before this, and we'll never be anything after that. But the mechanism you've used in this particular film has kind of, you know, the ghosts of Christmas past and future. And so I thought it was brilliant.
Oh, man, thank you. And that means a lot coming from you because you've dedicated your life to activism through comedy and through this art. And so I appreciate it. I think that with Antebellum, the Black women that I know, the Black women that I've grown up with, the Black women that have been so instrumental in shaping who I am today, I wanted to make sure within the context of the story that we're telling about American slavery that we're also seeing a depiction of Black women in the way that I experienced them. And so that was really important, that sort of triumph, which, you know, I think that we all walk around with this secret, this knowing as Black people, that we come from something really extraordinary. And I'm not talking about just our time here in America. I think that the ancestors are constantly trying to tell us that we come from a greatness that is beyond our imagination. And I think that for me as an artist, as a filmmaker, that I have to use my imagination to put that on the screen so that we can remind ourselves of all this greatness that we have.
Yeah, I think that's so important because I think a lot of times, you know, we've all heard that that saying that you are what you consume. So if you constantly consume images where we never triumph, or we just almost get there and no, it really kind of begins to take root in your soul, and somewhere in the back of your brain, you really feel as though, okay, well, I know, try as I might, I probably won't triumph. And I think it's so sad that even as children, you know, you kind of see that and you begin to be that. And it's so good to be able to see, I guess, a different image, if you will, on the screen in terms of knowing that there are triumphs and we do come from a beautiful people and place, and the types of lives that we lived and who we are innately still exist.
I think that that is the greatest source of pride for me. Is to be Black in America. It's my greatest source of pride. I walk around with this sense of coming from the absolute richest culture, a reservoir, as I said, of such beauty. And I'm tired of it being just about our strength and our resilience, because that also makes us, in many ways, in some of the depictions that we see, it's this superhuman quality, which that in and of itself discounts the humanity. And that we have had to endure so much, and we've still managed to have the audacity to not only survive, but in some cases thrive. So I have a responsibility, just like any other Black artist, to make sure that the art that I'm expressing and that I'm communicating, that first and foremost, I have to answer to my ancestors.
Yeah.
Have to answer to where I come from, and the stories that I want to see for Black children, for Black people generally speaking, so that we remember that within us there's always been the triumph, and we have the ability to take this situation and to turn it around. I think in America right now we've reached the precipice, and what I mean by that is I think that we're exhausted by the performance. As soon as we stop performing, when Colin said, I'm not going to perform this anymore, I'm going to tell the truth.
Right.
Pound of flesh.
Yeah.
As soon as you say that you're not, look, I got questions about America's founding. I've got questions about the things that you're saying about who we are and where we come from. I don't know if I believe that.
Right.
I don't know in what world should I be so prideful about a place that has, number one, I'm still walking around with the brand of that surname that you gave me.
All right, Colin Kaepernick, let me tell you something. Let me tell you something. You know what's interesting? Just hearing you talk, but Hollywood, I mean, storytelling is so seductive, like it, particularly on the large screen. Like I remember, I remember watching Rocky, and the story was so seductive that I actually rooted for the white dude. I was like, get him, Rocky! Get him!
Over Apollo!
over a dude who was excellent. I wanted him to win. And I'm going to tell you, in America, you can only get a statue if you brutalize Black people. Even Rocky had a statue. He had to beat three niggas up to get it. Like, it was... But the way that we can be seduced, and that's why stories are so important, because in my natural state, in my real world, I'd have never rooted for the dude who had every advantage and just only had to reach out and grab it versus the dude who had to literally fight his way. But that's the seduction, and that's the importance of owning, of having ownership of the stories, because they continually perpetuate a narrative and have us buy into it for their commercial success all the time. Like I literally can't imagine wanting, and I wanted him to win.
I mean, we have people, you know what happens with this intoxication of indoctrination of teaching us that everything about us is bad and everything about them is good, to the point that you end up with this crabs in a barrel syndrome, this idea of hate that perpetuates and expresses itself through our own community. And I think that we have to go back and dismantle that scaffolding that continues to support inequity in the way that we are depicted on screen, in the way that we look at ourselves and allow for them to tell us to forget about American slavery, but they continue to lubricate the prison pipeline and decimate our
communities.
So what I've come to understand within every fiber of my being is that he, she, they that control the narrative hold the keys.
Yeah. And you were talking about our ancestors speak, and I don't want to offend members of my family, but the greatest black woman, when I think of a person who's not here, a black woman who's not here anymore, it's my Aunt Nita. And she is the first time I ever really understood what love was her. And even though she loved me, and I was certain that she loved me, what she wanted me to do, all that they ever wanted us to do was survive. Black women wanted us to survive. They just want, that was it. I'm trying to get you from here to there and not die. I want you to survive. They never taught us how to live. And I think when you tell stories like you're telling in this, you take the homage to our ancestors, but the lens that they can't see through, which is not only surviving, but living and thriving, which are words that they would never say. I can't let these streets take you. I can't, like, everything was about keeping you alive. And art has a way of waking up something else inside of you. And I think that that's why it's important.
You know, what you said really struck a chord with me, because I think that I've shared a lot of those same experiences with aunts and my grandmother, who was a phenomenal woman. But at the same time, you're absolutely right. There was this idea that we got to get you from point A to point B. And then you start navigating life as a black person where you feel that whether you recognize it or not on a subconscious level, do I deserve this?
Yeah. Survivor's remorse. Yeah.
Is it okay to be good? Is it okay to be comfortable? And I think that us showing an example to ourselves, of ourselves, of triumph, of the idea that our excellence, our particular brand of humanity, it's beautiful, it's resilient, but the beauty doesn't lie in the resilience. The beauty lies just in our existing, and that's enough. And I think that when we teach ourselves and we teach the community and we teach our children, most importantly, that we've all been seeded with an extraordinary gift, which is to be black. There is so much pride in just being black. And that is, no, it's not enough. It's an extraordinary gift to have. It's up to you to decide what you're gonna do.
Sure.
But I think on the anathema to that is that you have kids and our community and you know, the idea that we're being taught by the media and by films that depict us as being less than the extraordinary thing that we are, that's an albatross that we need to liberate ourselves from immediately in every facet.
You know, a lot of trailers, like I haven't seen the film in full disclosure, but I saw the trailer. And because the trailers are just kind of like the thing that makes you go see it. But I oftentimes look for the things that they're not trying to help, let me see. The thing that I came away with after watching the trailer was this sense of restlessness, which I think artistically is the greatest canvas you can paint for. I think restlessness and this notion of being unsatisfied and being restless is something that you need to hold on to and harness. And I think, I don't know what you'll do after this, but I think that if you keep the same spirit that got you here, because, you know, Alexander Graham Bell, in order to invent the telephone, had to want to talk to a motherfucker that wasn't even there. You know, like, I feel like talking to people that ain't here. And I think you have to have that's lunatic. That's manic. That's a sense of lunacy. And you have to have that to have, and you have to have a very jaundiced eye. And I think whatever you do from here, if you don't do anything else, regardless of what happens here, I mean, I don't, every film you do, it may not be number one or every film you do, but as long as you keep that restlessness, that same thing that you have right now, that same itch that you can't scratch, I just can't imagine you can't do things that are so, that are indelible. And I wish you the best.
Oh, that means the world to me. I'll take that with me always, and I appreciate you all spending some time with me and having a conversation about race and antebellum. And I can't wait to come back with my next movie.
No, and when you take the film from A Birth of a Nation, I want you to do Shaft. I want you to take that. No, I want you to use that film and shoot the new Spook Who Sat by the Door. It'll be spectacular.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, man. Thank you, man. The best thing.